Welcome, folks. This is Tony for the A Minute to Midnight show. Our website, aminutetomidnight.com. Midnight spelled MIDNITE, where we put all of our shows and interviews and also articles. And you can donate to A Minute to Midnight on the website as well, and we really appreciate it if you could help us out that way. Today, our guest on the show is the return of Alexander Lawrence, Watchman Alexander, and it's a really interesting show. I hope you enjoy it. There's a lot of studying to do with it. I certainly found it very interesting. I'm glad to be able to welcome Alexander Lawrence back to the A Minute to Midnight show. We had you on, I think it was about October or November in 2017, and it's really, I think, time to have you back again. So it's really nice to be talking to you again today.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate you having me back. It's actually a big deal for a prophecy buff to get invited back anywhere.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because I have a few people that, you know, come on and with different ideas on the whole prophetic time scale and, you know, all kind of different from each other. And it's really interesting to get the different perspectives. But everyone seems to get on well. There's no real... you know, with the people that I talked with anyway, you know, that they're not at enmity with one another. They all sort of friends and get on quite well. And but it's just good to bounce ideas and come up with conclusions as to what is, because Bible prophecy is kind of confusing at times and there are a lot of different possibilities. So it's really interesting, I find, anyway, to kind of try and put the pieces together.
It is difficult. Some of it is simpler than other parts of it, but certainly it's something that requires a lot of study, requires a lot of discussion. And it's great that we can be part of the same family and the same kingdom, and we can have peace with one another while disagreeing on some of these matters. And then, you know, over time, I think the Spirit guides us each in the things that He wants us to zero in on and the ways that He wants us to adjust our view of things. And I fully believe that the Lord will guide us each to the place that we need to be as long as we're diligent in studying His word.
And the main thing is to, yeah, be diligent and keeping our eyes open, because whatever way you look at it, it certainly appears that Bible prophecy is unfolding rather rapidly as events change so quickly in the world. And the pieces, well, it's like a jigsaw puzzle when you see all the pieces being put into place. We haven't got all of the pieces in place yet, but there are some real aha moments.
Yeah, and so much is happening in the news just recently that it's hard to keep up with it all. I wouldn't say that we're seeing biblical prophecy unfold from day to day, but we are seeing a lot of things being set in place. You know, the stage is being set in a lot of ways. So that's pretty exciting to watch.
Oh, I agree with that. And yeah, the news does change rapidly. There seems to be so many new developments, almost hour by hour on some days, and it's like hard to keep up. But yep, we know that God is in control of end time events and where we're heading, and that's, you know, that's the most comforting thing. It's not like some out of control train wreck that no one's got the steering.
Right. Thank God we know basically where this stuff is going. I mean, I don't know how people who don't take the Bible seriously can deal with the calamity that occurs, you know, all of the unknowns of the world. Just living here is a scary, scary venture if you don't know basically how it's all going to turn out. And of course, we know the real end of the story is that those who trust in the Lord will be resurrected. We're going to get eternal life, and there's going to be eternal peace. So no matter what's going on here, we have that to look forward to. But in the meantime, it's nice to also know basically what's going to happen. We have a sequence of events that we can generally hold to, even if there's disagreements over the details. And we know in that, we know that God has it all planned already. It's all taken care of. You know, He is not surprised by any of it. He's written the story already, and there's great peace in that, and even joy to know that we can glorify God by showing people He's already talked about this. He's outside of all of this stuff, and how great that He is to let us know ahead of time what's going to happen.
And I really don't understand or know how people that don't have God actually do cope. You know, I don't know. I don't think I could do it. I wouldn't want to do it for a start. But the ultimate thing is, yeah, as you say, we know the end of the story, and we know that our salvation, if we trust in the Lord, is safe and secure, and doesn't matter what happens in the world, no one can take that away.
Exactly. Exactly. So, excuse me, by the way, I am getting over upper respiratory infection. So if I'm coughing a little bit and my voice is a little bit hoarse, that's why. I apologize in advance.
That's all good. I think there's a lot of that going around. The change of seasons, you're going one direction. Of course, we're heading towards winter here. And so there are a lot of people here with it as well. I had a sore throat yesterday and was thinking, oh no, is this happening? But today I'm fine, so which is really good. Now, where are we going to take this today, Alex?
I thought we could talk about the different beasts in prophecy, because this is an area where I continually see people struggling. You know, there's a lot of confusion. It's a difficult area of eschatology to dive into. So this discussion is going to require everyone to really put their thinking caps on, or else run away and come back later when you're ready for it, because, yeah, this is going to get pretty complicated. But I think if you just take it, you know, one step at a time, which I'm hoping to do, just give you one little bite at a time, then by the end of it, you're going to understand what these beasts are, and it will clear up a lot about the book of Revelation in particular, because the narrative switches back and forth between different beasts, sometimes without even telling you, which makes it really complicated. But we all know eschatology can be cryptic, so that's not really a surprise, but it is hard to follow. So hopefully this is going to help people to get it.
Sounds good. All right, so take us away. Where do we begin?
Well, I think we should begin with the fact that beasts, prophetically speaking, represent men or collections of men who are spiritually brutes. So there's a lot of symbolism that we're going to be covering today, and I'll tell you each time there's a symbol that we need to interpret. Usually the Bible, I would say always, really, the Bible interprets itself. So we just need to figure out what the scriptures have to say about these things, even though it might not be in, you know, if we're looking at one particular passage, the explanation might not be right there, but somewhere else in scripture, sometimes well hidden, but somewhere you're going to find the explanation for that symbol. And when it comes to beasts, I think we find that explanation in, well, I'll tell you what, maybe we'll kind of see it play out instead of me trying to explain it right off the bat. But I'll just prep you by saying that the beasts represent people who are spiritually opposed to God. They're wild. They're set against the Lord instead of being docile towards him. And they're unwilling to be subservient to the Most High. So a beast can be a person, or it can be a whole collection of people. We're going to see beast kingdoms and beast kings. And it's kind of funny that in the book of Daniel, we see one of the kings of a beast kingdom, whose name was Nebuchadnezzar, actually gets turned into a beast, quite literally, for several years, because he simply wouldn't humble himself. He was continually prideful, even after God showed him some miraculous things through the Jewish people. He would acknowledge Yahweh, the Most High, but he also still acknowledged all of the other gods and worshiped them as well. And so finally the time came when God said, no, I'm going to knock you down about 12 pegs, and you're going to be a literal beast in the fields eating grass for several years. So that was an interesting way of making what was figurative literal. But let's start out with Revelation chapter 13, for the first verse of that chapter. Let's go ahead and turn to Revelation 13, and we're going to read this. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and this is John seeing this vision. I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. On his horns were 10 crowns, and on his heads, blasphemous names. Verse 2. The beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. In that passage, we see a beast that's characterized as a few different beasts put together. Does that make you think of anything, Tony?
Well, various different kingdoms that we see arising today. But again, you know, the identity of some of them is a little bit of a mystery, I think. Well, to me anyway.
It is. It's an area of some conjecture. But what's interesting, and you're right, they're kingdoms, but these kingdoms were actually mentioned before. If we go back to the book of Daniel, to chapter 7, we find these very same animals are being used to represent three different kingdoms. So the one that John saw was just one beast, but it had the characteristics of these other three beasts. So we would call it a chimera, like a mixture. But in Daniel's vision, there's four different beasts, and they arise from a churning sea. Now, the Revelation 3 beast is, 13 beast, excuse me, is an amalgamation of these four beasts. And we're going to find out soon what the seven heads of John's beast represent. But in this vision with Daniel, only one of the beasts has multiple heads. So let me go ahead and turn back to Daniel chapter 7, and we will read that together. So he says, I saw in a vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard, with four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. And he goes on to describe this horn in a way that we understand that this is the end times ruler, the last king of all the empires of man, and we would call him the Antichrist. And he is the one who will butt heads with the Ancient of Days, the Lord himself, and the Messiah will come down and destroy him. Excuse me. But that's all we need for right now. So we see the different beasts represented, the kingdoms represented by different types of animals. And the number of heads, if you add them up, sums to seven. So there's four heads of the leopard beast, and each of the other ones has one head. So together that's seven heads, which is not exactly the same seven heads as the ones we're going to find in Revelation, but it's just interesting that the number pops up over and over. It's an important number. So the first thing to realize is that these beasts come up out of a churning sea, or a great sea that's been stirred up by the winds of heaven. What does that mean? Well, the angel who was speaking to John in Revelation chapter 17 provided the key to understanding the symbolism of the sea. And you'll find this same symbolism in other books as well. Recently, I've been teaching the book of Second Baruch, which is a rediscovered text, scripture, what I would call scripture, that was almost lost to time, but it has come back to us, and it's an amazing scripture. But in there, we also find the same symbolism of the sea in a dream that was given to Baruch. But here's the explanation of it. Revelation 17:15. And the angel said to me, the waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. So the waters of the sea represent all of these peoples and nations. Now the word there, if we were to use it, the Hebrew word would be goyim, the nations, meaning those other than Israel, which is made clear later on that this is not including God's people, that this is only the Gentile people, the ones that are opposed, which is why the woman we call Mystery Babylon, Babylon the Great, is sitting on these people because she's ruling over these nations, these goyim. She's not ruling over God's kingdom because the Messiah is the one who rules over us. But the ancient people, including the authors of the Bible, equated the sea with chaos. You can go back to ancient writings from a lot of different cultures, and you'll find that they always consider the sea chaos, and it was represented usually by a sea serpent, which is what the Bible would call Leviathan. But in any case, chaos is just always connected with the sea because the sea lacks structure. It's constantly moving and changing. It doesn't have any stability. Well, likewise, the Gentile nations, they don't have stability. They're not at peace in the kingdom of God. They're constantly in this state of flux. So that's why that symbol is used. Well, in Daniel's vision, the sea is not just its normal self. It's being churned up. It's raging. So what that tells us is that we're looking at a time of global calamity where, you know, knowing what the angel told to John, that these waters are people, that means the churning of the waters indicates people who are just in calamity, chaos. There's some sort of a large shift going on, probably worldwide. And the sea, as we've said, is figurative, which goes right along with the fact that these beasts are figurative too. So everything in this vision is an analogy or a symbol. It's not to be taken literally. But then the angel does go on to explain it literally to Daniel. So if we jump down to Daniel 7, verse 17, we have the angel's explanation of this. And he says, "These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise in the earth." They're four kings. So what I'm about to say here is a theory. I can't really be dogmatic about it, but I think these kings are angelic principalities. I don't think that these are earthly kings. I think that remember last time we were talking, it's been a while, but last time I was on here, I mentioned something about the Cosmocrators, which are these fallen angelic rulers, members of the divine council, as Michael Heiser would call it, who have rebelled against God and are in this lawsuit against him. Well, I think that it's these Cosmocrators. At the Tower of Babel, 70 people groups were created. God divided all the people by giving them new languages, and there were 70 of them, if we go back to the book of Genesis. And in the book of Deuteronomy, we're told that God assigned those 70 people groups of the Goyim to the sons of God, or the B'nai Elohim, which are what the Greeks would call Cosmocrators. So those guys are the little g gods of the nations, and they're ruling over all of the Gentiles right now. I think that these four kings represented by beasts are four of those Cosmocrators that get their shot at things in the last days. So I think they're fallen sons of God that we're looking at here. But then particular characteristics of the beasts are going to be earthly kings, but we'll see that here in a bit.
So do those four angelic, fallen angels, do they actually have a certain range? Like they set as a sort of a principality over an area? Is that how it works, do you think?
I think, well, over a people group, I would say. Probably not a geographical area.
Okay.
Yeah. There's an interesting passage elsewhere in Daniel that talks about a fallen one who was not permitting one of the holy angels to get through to Daniel. He was called the Prince of Persia.
That's what came to my mind as you were talking about it. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. So he was the prince of that people called Persia. And later on in the New Testament, we find Paul talking about the principalities and the powers of the air. And this is what he's referring to. He's talking about these spiritual rulers who are the bad guys. I mean, in context, when you read that, you realize he's talking about the enemy. So together they rule the nations, and these are all set against God and his kingdom. So even though these beasts are kings of some sort, they also represent kingdoms. So at the same time that they're kings, they're kingdoms, because when, you know, every king has a kingdom, every kingdom has a king. And this is made clear by the angel a few verses later. If we skip down to verse 23, we see the angel say, "Thus he said, as for the fourth beast, it shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms." So the angel has just told Daniel, that these beasts are four kings. But then he goes on in a few verses to say the fourth of these beasts is a fourth kingdom. And that's tipping us off to the fact that these are both. It's either or, right? King and kingdom is interchangeable in Scripture. And that's really critical to understand when we're trying to interpret Revelation chapter 13. So let's go back to that. Revelation 13.
Just before you do, I noticed that fourth king, it says that shall devour the whole earth. So it's not just a small kingdom.
Right. This is the one that takes over everything.
Yeah. Okay.
And Revelation 13, verse 3, we read this. One of the heads looked like it had been wounded fatally. His fatal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled at the beast. Verse 4, they worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? So in this two verses, we see a subtle shift happen from talking about a nation to talking about a king. Because we were introduced to this seven-headed beast that comes up out of the sea, like Daniel's beast. But in this case, he is being worshipped as evidently an individual, because nobody worships a kingdom. No. I've never seen anybody worship a kingdom. You worship kings sometimes because kings claim to have divine right to rule, or at least they almost always did in the past. So you could definitely worship a divine king, or you could worship the power behind the king, but you wouldn't worship his kingdom. So the heads are individual earthly kings of this great empire. And we're going to learn more about this in a little bit, but I just wanted to set that up right now. The head that was healed, it says one of the heads was healed, and he was previously dead because his wound was fatal. So this king or this head was totally destroyed. It was a fatal wound, and yet he lives. And that's an important distinction to make, because we need to realize that a head of this symbolic beast was slain, not necessarily that the person was slain by a head wound. Okay. And that there's a lot of people that get that mixed up.
Yeah, I agree. I'm glad you clarified that. Because you see people looking for someone to be assassinated and then come back to life, you know, like some people say it'll be a false miracle or whatever, but I don't think that's actually what it's talking about. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and let's come back to that in a little bit, because there's another verse that has to do with that. Let's just jump down to it right now. Revelation 13, verse 12. It talks about this other beast that we'll get to in a minute, but he causes the inhabitants of the world to worship this first beast whose mortal wound was healed. That's verse 12, whose mortal wound was healed. So this person who's being worshiped did have a mortal wound. He did die. And then again, let me see if I can find it. It's in that same section. It says he was slain with the sword, verse 14, there it is. So 12 says he had a mortal wound that was healed, and then verse 14 kind of reiterates that, but it gives us an additional piece of information, because it says that he was wounded by the sword and yet lived. Okay, so one of the heads is slain and by a sword, but this can't be talking about a person, because nobody has multiple heads. This is not a king with polycephaly. This is a king among other kings, and one of this group of kings is killed and then comes back, and that's why people are worshiping him. So the individual beast that we've shifted to here in chapter 13, we started with the beast empire, which we know because Daniel explains it's four different kingdoms, and they all are merged together somehow. And then as we were talking about this beast empire, the narrative shifts to talking about an individual beast who we call the Antichrist. And this beast doesn't come up out of the sea. He comes up from the abyss. That's an important distinction to make as well, because the beast empire is said to come from the sea, both in Daniel and in Revelation. It comes up out of the sea. But the individual beast that is going to be the ruler who is worshipped, this beast is from the abyss. So End Times Babel is this empire that has taken over the other kingdoms, the leopard kingdom, the lion with the wings, and the bear kingdom are all subsumed under this end times kingdom, which you might call the New World Order, but what is probably more accurately called Babel, the end times Babel. It will also be Rome, but we can get back around to that later. But Rome is an incarnation of Babel, and Rome never really died. And we're looking at a time here very shortly where Rome will grow again in power, and it will be that fourth kingdom that Daniel saw that ends up consuming, because it says in Daniel, it trampled down the rest of them. It took over the other beast kingdoms and incorporated them, assimilated, we should say. So the abyss is different from the sea, because the abyss is not a figurative thing. It's actually a real geographical feature of the world. And we know that from studying the rest of scripture, that the abyss, also called the bottomless pit, is a part of Sheol. It's a part of the underworld. And so whoever this is that is being represented as this beast who gets worshipped, he comes from the underworld, from Sheol, which is where the souls of the disembodied souls of the dead go to rest. So this is very intriguing. And anybody who doesn't just get so, worked up, so excited about figuring this out, I think is not really paying attention, because it's quite the mystery. Okay, so let's go to Revelation chapter 11, verse 7 really quickly, because it mentions this guy. It says, and it's talking about the two witnesses who testify in Jerusalem for 3.5 years. And it says, when they have finished their testimony, the beast that rises from the abyss will make war on them and conquer them and kill them. Are you familiar with this? Do you know what this is talking about?
Abaddon, or yeah, I'm looking at it here, right here. I'm interested to know what your thoughts on it will be, because everyone has a slightly different view on it. I kind of tie. Personally, I start to wonder and tie it in with the whole alien deception and all that as well. Yeah, anyway, that's kind of my thoughts without going too far into them.
Mm-hmm. I do think that the whole ancient aliens phenomenon does have something to do with how it all unfolds at the end. I would agree with that. But in this chapter, I think most theologians are agreed, and I'm on board with them, that this character is the Antichrist, and it's he who will kill the two witnesses. Lots of other people will try. They won't succeed. The witnesses will be able to kill them with fire whenever they're attacked. But finally, after 3.5 years, the Antichrist himself will attack them, and they will either not defend themselves, or for some reason will no longer have their powers. I'm assuming just because they realize that the time has come, and like Yeshua, they're going to kind of lay themselves down as martyrs. But he is able to kill them, and he hangs them up for everyone to see, and then they're resurrected after 3 days. And then that point, if you correlate it with what we see in the book of Daniel about the last 7 years, or the 70th week of Daniel, hopefully most people have heard of that, the 70th week of Daniel, which a lot of people will call the tribulation period. The Bible doesn't actually call it that, but the 70th week is certainly a term that's there. And in that last 7 years, in the middle of it, is when these witnesses would be killed, and then the Antichrist would set himself up as God in the temple. We know that he will desolate the temple. He will bring an end to the sacrifices. He will break the covenant that he has made with many people. And that's the point at which he is claiming to be God himself, and desires to be worshipped in the place of God. So he will accomplish what, at least in an earthly sense, what Isaiah 14 talks about, of the king of Babel wanting to ascend the hill of God and set himself up in the place of God.
Which to me kind of, I struggle to see how any earthly person, normal earthly person, would be worshipped in this day and age, you know, which is why I wonder about if there's a fallen angel, angelic sort of slash alien deception, whether this person will not be fully human, be more than just a human.
Yeah, I think there's a very good argument to be made that when it talks about the seed of Satan in the first chapters of Genesis, was it Genesis 3? Right after the curse, when God says that the seed of the woman will be the one to redeem. It's also said that the seed of the serpent or the Nahash, who I would equate with Satan, just, yeah. You know, whether that was him or not, he was in his kingdom, right? Yeah. He was one of the fallen ones. So the seed of the Nahash would have his head crushed by the righteous seed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I would say there's a good reason to believe that there is actual, there's something physical about that, where the DNA or whatever code angels have is somehow mixed with a man to create this hybrid. Just like we had hybrids in the pre-flood world, angels.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's kind of where I'm coming from too. So I'm glad to know that you're on that page as well. So cool.
Yeah. There's a lot of room to conjecture about how that would possibly happen. But it's a good possibility.
I think that the point to, you know, I want to make is that if we do come up with some sort of alien disclosure and all of that, that people aren't taken aback by it if that's the way it goes. Not that it necessarily will, but I do think that's a possibility, and that people will be fooled by some sort of a disclosure or system that says, you know, that man came from, was brought to earth or put here and bred here from some far off planet, and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, to basically, because evolution's falling apart as an argument, so they, you know, have a different one. So yeah, how it plays out, I'm not exactly sure, but if that is the way it was to come about, you know, I could see a lot of people falling for it if they weren't aware that this is a distinct possibility as a fallen angel kind of masterminded scheme.
Absolutely. Well, I don't know if the argument will be that these entities are extra dimensional or extraterrestrial, but either way, I think they're going to tell us that there is a battle going on between two different species of these ascended beings, these higher beings from somewhere. And that really fits right in with what the occult has been teaching forever, which is that the angel that was in the garden, you know, tempting Adam and Eve to take of the tree, was really a good guy. He was the probably the leader of this faction of immortals that wanted to help Adam and Eve to ascend, to become enlightened. And the Gnostic religion has, you know, in its different forms, has always taught that Yahweh of the Bible is actually the bad guy. He wants to oppress. He wants to keep us, you know, under his rule and not let us become greater than we are. Whereas his enemy, Lucifer, the light bearer, you know, he wants to bring us this illumination and help us to evolve into gods. You know, you will be as gods. That's what he said in the garden. And I think that's exactly what he's going to say in the end times too, but just with a twist of, you know, oh, these gods throughout history, they're actually this really advanced species that's either from a different plane of existence or a different planet.
Yeah, and it's interesting that that's the way the transhumanists are going as well, and, you know, seeking to become like God too, which is a whole other thing. I don't want to derail us, but yeah.
Yeah, we could go off on that for a while too. Okay, so back to talking about this man from the abyss. So the guy in Revelation chapter 11 who kills the two witnesses, it says he rises from the abyss, or he has risen from it before this point that he comes and takes out the two witnesses. So that's very important, because we're talking about the same person as we found in Revelation 13, who's going to be worshipped by the whole world. And then in Revelation 17, verse 8, we read the angel talking to John. He says, "The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the abyss and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast." There's that word again. They're going to marvel at this guy, because it was and is not and is to come. So the angel is explaining to John why it is that the whole world marvels after this person who's a beast ruler. He says it's because he was, so he existed at one point in the past. He is not. Now that's talking about John's present day, right? Not our present day, because this was him speaking to the apostle at that time. So about 90 AD. And then he is to come. So currently in John's time, he did not exist, but he did before and he will again. That is kind of the crux of my whole book, Leviathan's Ruse, or it's one of the big things in there, is understanding this verse and understanding why this character is someone who comes back. The Antichrist is not someone who comes on the scene for the first time at the end of time. He's someone who has been here before as one of these great rulers, one of the seven heads, and he'll return. But I'll get into that a little deeper here in just a minute. So this, again, this ties back into Revelation 13, verses 3 and 4, where it talks about this man being worshipped. And we need to realize this is why he's worshipped. And we also need to realize, I think, Revelation, not I think, it's important to me that everybody understands that Revelation is not chronological. Now, I know a lot of people are going to get thrown for a loop by that because there have been so many teachers that have said it is chronological. And I think I would say most dispensationalist prophecy buffs would teach you, yes, this is mostly linear with maybe one little section of, that's parenthetical, but basically it's chronological. And actually, no, it's not. It's in sections that are organized thematically. And then they're within those thematic sections, it's chronological. But they are giving us a view of events of the end. Now, different stretches of time leading up to the end and focusing on particular things in each one of those segments. It's too much to tell people everything that's going on when you're trying to teach things topically. So you take one stretch of time and you focus on one particular line of action. And then you step back and you start at another point of time, wherever it makes the most sense to start. And you focus on another line of action. And that's what's happening in the book of Revelation. And this is really great evidence that we just looked at, that that's what's happening. Because in chapter 17, which is towards the end of Revelation, we're finding the angel saying that this beast is yet to come in the sequence of events involving the whore of Babylon and the 10 kings of Babylon, or Babel. So he is not yet on the scene in the way that the angel is describing this to John. And yet, the same person who comes up from the abyss, which is the language that we find in verse 8 of Revelation 17, if we go back to Revelation 11, that guy from the abyss is already there. He's already in a position of power, and he kills the two witnesses. So again, it's by theme. It's introducing this character to us earlier in the book, but then it's giving us more information about him from a different time standpoint later in Revelation. Maybe sometime we can talk more about all the different things in Revelation that tell us that it's not chronological, and we can kind of break it apart and see where the different chunks are. But moving on, speaking of Babel again, the beast empire of Revelation 13:1 has reversed what happened at Babel. So the fall of Babel split apart mankind and so that he could not cooperate anymore. The efforts of all of the people were frustrated because the different languages prevented them from communicating. And so they spread out and they filled the whole earth, which is what God had asked them to do in the first place. Since then, there have been attempts to try and undo that. Kingdoms have spread out and tried to take all of the other major civilizations in the world and combine them all into one kingdom. The first one to do that was a man named Assur, who I think was Nimrod. And I spend some time in my book talking about why I believe that. But this character, you go back to Genesis chapter 10, you see that he founded Babel and Uruk and some of those first cities down in the plains of Shinar in southern Mesopotamia. And then he went up to Assyria, the land that is named after him, because he was Asher or Assur. And he made that nation and he founded a bunch of cities in what is now Assyria. And this guy, if we look in Ezekiel chapter 31, there's a whole chapter about him. And it's a parable because he's talked about as a tree, as a great tree. And the Lord tells Ezekiel, this king was over, he was the greatest king of the whole world that will ever be. He was the tallest. He had his branches out over the entire world. Everything else was underneath his canopy. And it's a fascinating chapter that people don't study very often, but it really contains a lot of important information. Actually, that whole sequence of chapters from Ezekiel 28 through 31 is just rife with prophetic information. But in any case, Ashur, this great ruler, he already tried very hard to reverse Babel, but he wasn't allowed to do that. God ordered that he was to be killed, and guess what? He was slain by the sword. Chapter 31 of Ezekiel makes it clear that it was a sword that killed this king, and he was the greatest king of the world, which goes against what secular historians will tell you. They don't understand that in the early world after the fall of Babel, there was a man who went around conglomerating all of the different people that were trying to spread out and bringing them under one kingdom. Now, obviously, there was only so much he could do because people spoke different languages. And, you know, as they were continuing to spread out, I can imagine it was very difficult to try and bring all of that under one umbrella. But he succeeded to an amazing degree, according to chapter 31. So this guy is the same one that we're seeing from the abyss in Revelation, who has done what he originally was trying to do. He has reversed Babel, because that's what the chimera of chapter 13, Revelation 13, is showing us, that one kingdom has taken over all of the other kingdoms. They are now ruling over the whole world, what we would call the New World Order. It's taken over everything. And with all of the different civilizations under one umbrella, now the world can, and of course we have these technologies now that allow us to translate between languages very well, and that's getting better and better every day. So we really are reversing the effects of Babel, and that's incredibly dangerous, of course, because we know what happened the first time. So we've seen two beasts so far. We saw the beast empire that came up out of the sea, and we saw the beast ruler who came up out of the abyss. The third and last beast to look at is the false prophet. He comes from the earth, not from the sea. So Revelation 13 says, verse 11 says, "Then I saw another beast rising up out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all authority of the first beast in its presence, and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed." So this beast is another one, but it doesn't come out of the same place. It's out of the earth. Well, we know that the sea are the Gentile people, so the earth has to be what remains. It has to be God's people, the kingdom of Israel. And a lot of people have ideas about the false prophet, that he's going to be the Pope, or he's going to be some kind of a Muslim leader or something like that. But from the symbolism that we're given here, that's not true. This guy will actually be an Israelite. And most likely, in my opinion, he will be a Jewish religious leader. And I don't know that for sure, but that's my best guess, because he seems to be acting in the role of a religious leader. Certainly, he's called a prophet. So that is a fascinating thing to realize, is that one of the— and we can go back and connect this to a lot of Old Testament prophecies that talk about how the Israelites will enter into a covenant with this person who they think is their Messiah, and he's going to turn on them. And it actually connects that with death. It says that there's a covenant that they've made with death and Sheol. And you have to wonder, what is that talking about? How can the Jews in the end of the age be making a covenant with Sheol? But when you connect it to what's said in Revelation, it makes perfect sense, because this ruler has come up out of the abyss, and the abyss is in Sheol. So they've literally made a covenant with this this man who has come from Sheol.
So he can't be just a literal man, can it? It's got to be something more, because, you know, when somebody dies and they go to either heaven or hell or Sheol or whatever you want to call it, that they don't normally come back out. God just doesn't go, oh, well, I'll let this fellow come back to earth again. So it's got to be a principality. It's got to be a spirit being that's bigger than just a man.
Well, I don't think so. I think it's a man. And part of the reason I think that is because many of the ancient people, the occult leaders, the priesthoods of the ancient people, they believe that they would be able to bring back this man eventually. In Egypt, his name was Osiris. Now, yeah, that's the Greek rendering of it, but the name in Egypt was Osir, just like it was in Mesopotamia. Osir, it's the same guy.
But is it actually just a person, though, or is it a principality that perhaps inhabited a body? Or are we talking about some DNA that's resurrected or what? You know, or is God just going to go, well, we'll let this one particular chap arise out of Sheol, though we keep everyone else locked in there? You know, what are your thoughts?
It's a good question. Two things. I think that the DNA has been preserved, and I think that we're going to be able to bring him back with genetic engineering if we haven't already. And we have the technology now. We can actually do it. I have an article that I quote in my book that talks about being able to bring back a dead man because they have his semen on a hand cloth, a handkerchief. So the technology is there.
But the spirit of that person can't come back because the spirit is...
That's right.
Yeah, so they could resurrect somebody from the DNA and resurrect the body. But then what is the spirit that inhabits that body?
Spirit?
Yeah.
I think there's two possibilities. One is some kind of arcane arts, because we know that you know, the Bible tells us magic and sorcery is possible. The Witch of Endor was able to bring up the soul, of the prophet Samuel. So there are arcane arts that allow people to be brought up, at least temporarily, in some cases. And we don't know how that might work together with bringing back the body of someone. But the other possibility is just that the abyss has been opened, because when we read in Revelation chapter, was it 10 or 11, that the abyss, that an angel comes down with the key to the abyss and unlocks it. And out of the abyss comes this ruler named Abaddon or Apollyon.
Yeah.
So somebody is actually released from the abyss. Now, the abyss is a separate portion of Sheol. The Sheol is broken into different areas. One is called torment, one is called paradise, and one is called the bottomless pit or the abyss. And these things they're locked from each other. So you can't go from paradise to torment. And that's why when Yeshua was telling the parable about Lazarus in the bosom of Abraham, Abraham looked at the rich man in torment and he said, we can't get to you. There's a gap. There's a vast chasm between us. Well, that's the abyss. So they can't, just because you open the abyss doesn't necessarily mean souls are going to come out of paradise or torment. But like we were talking about earlier, there may be something regarding the seed of the Nakash, the seed of the fallen one, that got mixed with this king. And he may have now an angelic spirit, which would go into the abyss part, not the torment part, because torment is for human souls. The abyss part is where the apostles in the Book of Enoch tells us that the fallen angels were locked up. So there's a little bit of detective work that has to go on, but I think that the general idea is this person is somehow let out of the abyss.
You've just clarified it quite well, because it's not just a normal wicked person that's gone into Sheol or hell or whatever you want to call it. This is some sort of other being.
Right. There's something different about him.
Yeah.
So we talked about the false prophet was the third beast, and we talked about, let's see, where were we? In addition to these three beasts, there's one other creature in Revelation that we should be aware of, because in Revelation 12, we see a monster with similar characteristics to the beast kingdom, but this is not an earthly beast. It's a cosmic dragon. And it represents Satan, which we know from Revelation chapter 20. It says Satan, the ancient serpent, is the dragon who is going to be thrown and locked up in the abyss. the dragon is shown prior to that in Revelation chapter 12, and it's described this way. Behold, a great dragon, it says, another sign appeared in heaven, a great dragon with seven heads and 10 horns, and on his heads, seven crowns. Okay, so first of all, this is a symbol because it says it's a sign. It's not literally a creature, but this sign is of a dragon who has seven heads, 10 horns, and 10 crowns. And his tail sweeps down a third of the stars, and then he stands before the woman trying to devour the Messiah when he's born. Well, this is certainly Satan, but a lot of us would think of Satan as being one individual entity. And certainly there is an individual entity at the top of the hierarchy. We know that from Ezekiel chapter 28, I believe.
Yeah.
And he's at the top of everything, but there are these cosmocrators, these other fallen angels who are seraphim, who are also rebelling, who are part of the adversary, because that's what Satan means. It just means adversary. So they're all adversaries of us. And what this symbol is telling us is that it's made up of 70 of these angels, which is what we talked about earlier, the divine council. There were 70 that rebelled, 70 nations. They were created at Babel. And then again, here in Revelation, we see 70 because seven heads times 10 horns is 70 rulers. And then he has seven crowns on those heads, and those seven crowns, it doesn't tell us explicitly what that's about, but I'm pretty sure that those crowns are representing the kings that are the heads of the earthly beast. So, of course, behind the beast empire is this angelic group of beings, these powers, these principalities of the air. And they're set, the seven crowns that they wear would then be linked to the seven heads of that beast empire. But that's not explicitly stated, so it's a little bit of a jump there, but I think that's what it means. So this is a lot of stuff to keep straight, and that's why people have such difficulty with it, because you have this dragon with seven heads, you have a beast empire with seven heads, then you have a beast king that's part of that empire, that's one of those heads, and then you have a beast from the earth that's the false prophet. But hopefully, now that's clear that those are different characters. Are you pretty on board with that
yes,
at this point?
Yes. Okay. And so, see, the one thing I always try and bring out too, as a lot of people miss, is that from Revelation 13:4, where it says they worshipped the dragon, which gave power to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, but they actually worshipped the beast, worshipped the dragon, sorry, which you've just said, and quite rightly so, is Satan. So I think, you know, to me, that the final religion is going to be a direct worshipping of the dragon, or worshipping of Satan. It won't be some proxy sort of religion. It's going to be pretty plain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll be worshipping the Antichrist, but also the power behind him, the dragon, and they're going to know that they're doing that. Now, how is the dragon going to be presented, I think, is the question, and we touched on that a little bit earlier. Like, that may be part of the alien deception.
Yeah,
that people see this as the ruler of this great extra-dimensional or extraterrestrial empire. But we'll just have to wait and see how that all turns out.
Exactly. We don't really know. But I just find it hard to believe that it could be somebody worshipping Allah as an Islamic Antichrist, which a lot of people believe. To me, that just doesn't fit that picture. I think, you know, when you look back at Lucifer and his desire for worship and his pride, he's not going to be happy to be worshipped as a proxy. It's going to be, you're going to know when you take that mark, when you enter that system, you are going to know exactly who it is you're worshipping and swearing allegiance to. It's not going to be just some kind of, oh, well, they're tossed into the lake of fire because they took a mark and they didn't really understand it. I think that people are going to know exactly what they're doing, and whether it's something that changes their DNA or whatever, I think is a possibility, but there's a distinction between taking the mark of the beast. It's not, you know, and what happens to those people and just the regular people that have died without Christ all the way through history. I think there's a kind of a separation in terms of how the importance of it. So that's why I don't think it'll just be an RFID chip. I think it's going to be something far more than that. and they're going to know who it is exactly that they're worshipping and giving their allegiance to. And yeah, whether it is an alien deception, and I mean, I don't know exactly how it's going to play out, but those are kind of my thoughts on that anyway.
Yeah, I'm right on board. And I'm afraid the Muslims are really, they've been set up by the fallen ones to be cannon fodder more than anything else. I don't think we're going to see Islam rise to be the mystery Babylon or the end times empire. And we can talk a little bit about why Rome is, the reborn Rome is going to be that fourth beast kingdom. But based on Psalm 83 and Ezekiel 38 and the number of Muslim nations that are going to be attacking Israel and getting wiped out in the process, I don't think that they're going to play that big of a part after that.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that.
Okay, so we've talked about the beast empire having seven heads, but we haven't really said what they are, other than they're kings. But let's read Revelation 17, 8 through 14 real quickly, or at least part of this, and it will give us more insight. The angel says to John, "The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the abyss and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast because it was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom." Okay, so what he's about to explain, you have to have wisdom to understand. And God made it this way for a reason. So if you want to understand, if you desire, and you don't have to, but if you desire to understand what's being said about what's going to unfold, you must ask God for wisdom. And the Bible says he will give it liberally. So the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven and it goes to destruction. And the ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for an hour together with the beast. These are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and it goes on to talk about them making all of these martyrs of the saints. So this is confusing because the angel is talking about two beasts simultaneously. And he can do this because, remember, kings and their kingdoms are interchangeable. But if you don't realize that he's switching back and forth, you're going to get really confused. So the seven kings represent seven, are represented by heads, and those heads are seven rulers throughout history. And those rulers are ones who have been the types of Antichrist. How do I know they're not contemporaneous and they're sequential? I know because the angel says some have already lived and died. One is presently ruling at the time of John having this vision, and some are still to come. So probably Emperor Nero was the Antichrist-like ruler, the Caesar, over Rome at the time when John was having the vision, and he would be one of these seven kings. But before him came others, probably Pharaoh, Sennacherib, certainly Antiochus Epiphanes, who was a ruler of Greece, because he did exactly what the Antichrist is going to do. He went to the temple in Jerusalem, defiled it, sacrificed pigs on the altar, and he set up the statue of Zeus in the temple. So that would be an abomination of desolation. He desolated the temple, and that's exactly what Antichrist will do. So, you know, really we're seeing a type of the Antichrist there. But these seven kings are ones who ruled over different iterations of Babel down through the ages. So out of Babel came Assyria and Egypt and Greece and Phoenicia and Rome eventually. You know, all of these really came from the civilization that was created there in Mesopotamia at the beginning of the age. And that's what these heads are telling us, that these are the seven Antichrist kings throughout history. It's a shift in thinking because, you know, we want to, part of the difficulty is that the 10 horns on these heads are ruling all at once. These are the 10 rulers, the kings of that final empire at the end of the age. They are not spaced out over all of history. And we know that because we can tie it to the 10 toes of the statue that Daniel saw that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about. And those 10 toes, the angel explicitly tells him, or Daniel tells him, are 10 kings at the end of the age. So those 10 horns are going to exist later. We haven't gotten to that point yet, but the 7 heads are spaced out over the whole course of history. And according to Daniel, the Antichrist is an 11th horn who rises among the 10, and he displaces 3 of them. So 10 minus 3 leaves 7. So there will be 7 horns remaining after the Antichrist displaces 3 of them. So that means he'll be the 8th horn. So he went from being the 11th horn to becoming the 8th horn. And he's also the 8th head, because we go back to verse 11, as we read before, the beast that was is not. It is an 8th, but it belongs to the 7. You know, no wonder it takes wisdom to understand this, because he's one of the 7, but he's an 8th. How does that work? You know, the only way it can work is that he came back. He was one of the 7 and he came back. And now he's not only the 8th head, he's also the 8th horn. And an 8, of course, in Bible numerology is interesting because it's the first after the cycle of 7. So the first day of the week is the 8th day, as well as the first day of the week. So he who is number 1 becomes number 8, and that is this ancient king Asher or Nimrod.
Very, very interesting. Alexander, if you could maybe just wrap up with any final thoughts on this, and what do you think is the main thing that people should take out of this today?
I think they need to be aware that, you know, based on what we just studied here, somebody is coming back, someone who ruled the world before. There is a resurrection, and that shouldn't surprise us, because we know that he's the false Messiah. And the false Messiah copies, he mimics everything that the real Messiah has done, or at least a lot of it. And we see that throughout many verses. So just as the real Messiah was resurrected, this person will also be resurrected. Now, it's not the same type of resurrection. It's not by the power of God. It's probably by the power of engineering and arcane arts or something like that. But nonetheless, he's going to come back. And the ancient Egyptians said that they preserved his efflux under Giza. So they actually believed that by preserving his genetic material, that one day he would come back, which is why they have all of these myths about Osiris, the mummy Osiris, coming, rising back up. And they worshipped that every year. Year after year, they kind of played it out like a like one of the appointed times. It was a role-playing thing. So they expected him to come back, and they still do. The occult still believes that. And if we're not ready for that, we're going to be very, very confused. A lot of Christians will be taken off guard, and that could be a big part of the great deception, is that, wait a minute, someone's been resurrected. The Bible never told us about this. You know, we thought there was only one resurrection, and yet this guy has been brought back as well. But the Bible actually does tell us about it. And that's what I'm trying to help people to understand, is that it tells you what kingdoms are going to come, and it tells you the king that's going to come, and that he was here before. So don't be deceived.
That's really good advice. And I think we're going to have to come back fairly soon and do another show, because there's so much more that we could, you know, discuss. We've hardly scratched the surface in terms of what the various kingdoms are, and what roles do America and Russia play, and the Middle East, and all of these things in all of this, going back to Daniel and things as well. So, Alexander, it's been absolutely awesome having you on today, but let's schedule to do another show really soon, if that's okay with you.
That'd be great. Yeah, I'd love to.
So just before we go, can you give us – give our listeners your website and also the name of your book?
Absolutely. It's watchmanalexander.com, WATCHMAN, so singular, watchmanalexander.com. And there's links to my book and my course and podcast and blog and all that stuff on the website. And also, please sign up for the newsletter. While you're there, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of any of the pages on the website, and you'll see a link where you can get a free ebook for signing up for the newsletter. You don't have to stay on the newsletter either. You can unsubscribe if you want to after getting the book, but I would encourage you to be subscribed so you know when I release new materials, because I'm working on a book called The Prophecy Cheat Sheet. And I'm also, as well as working on the second volume of Leviathan's Ruse a little bit. But more than that, my efforts right now are going into creating the first several or few chapters of a fiction novel that is going to be based on the research that I did for Leviathan's Ruse. So it'll be historical fiction. And I think it's really going to be exciting. So far, it's getting rave reviews with those who have read it. So if you want to get in on that, I'm probably going to be running a crowdfunding campaign for it over the next month or so. And you can be involved in that, or just, you know, be aware of the progress and get to read the first few chapters for free as soon as I'm done with those, just for being on the newsletter.
That's awesome. So yeah, folks, definitely check out Alexander's website, and thank you again for that information, Alex.
Yeah, thank you. And appreciate you having me on. It was really a lot of fun.
Cool, and I enjoyed it too. And we'll have to do it again very soon. As I mentioned earlier, folks, you can donate to A Minute to Midnight on our website, aminutetomidnight.com. There are a couple of options there for donating, and we really do appreciate it. There's only a small number of people that do donate, but we can't run this without you. And to be honest, it's been pretty slow of late, and we're certainly not making a killing off it. If you can help us, that'd be great. Also support Alexander Lawrence and his ministry. He's not exactly raking it in either, and I'm sure he'd really appreciate if you could help him out and buy his book, which is a great read. And any way else you can help ministries like his, I think it's really greatly appreciated. And you can find all the A Minute to Midnight shows on our website. We keep archives of them there. You can also find them on YouTube and on iTunes. And don't forget to click the like button on YouTube if you're watching it there. We appreciate that too. And I write, play, and record all the music in our shows, and you can find some free music on the A Minute to Midnight website as well. And we do have a community forum too, which you're welcome to join and participate in on the website. Well, that's it for this show. We'll be back in a few days with another episode of the A Minute to Midnight show. Until then, God bless and have a great week. So until the next show, this is Tony signing off.